This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. In the weeks of protest across the country after the death of George Floyd, there have been calls to change police use of force policies and calls to defund the police. And law enforcement agencies are making changes, in some cases requiring officers to step in if they see inappropriate use of force. But what does defund the police actually mean? Well, joining me for a conversation about protest and police reform is Rel Black. He's the founder of the Daytona Beach Nonprofit Community Healing Project. Thanks so much for being here.
Hey, good morning, good afternoon. Peace and love, everybody. Peace and love. Thank you for having me.
And we're hoping to hear from Volusia County Sheriff Mike Chitwood as we progress in the show as well. Hopefully he can join us in a little bit. You can join the conversation as well. You can send us your questions and comments on Twitter. We are at WMFE Orlando. Well, Rel, I want to start with you and just by asking, first of all, I read that you were run over during a protest in the last couple of weeks and had to spend a night in hospital. How are you doing?
Yes, I'm doing pretty good. You know, I'm recovering. It's taking a little time. Mm-hmm. Luckily, I had no broken bones, but there seems to be a bit of nerve damage, and it's a painful process. But I think in the spirit of activism, that comes with it. You know, I'm okay with it because I know in my heart of hearts we were doing the right thing. We were spreading a positive, peaceful message. And no matter how anyone feels, you know, they didn't ruin our mission and they didn't ruin our goal. So I'm satisfied with that. I'm definitely satisfied.
And of course, you know, here at WMFE, we've been focusing more on the protests in Orlando and the sort of municipalities closer to Orlando. But what's the scene been like out in the Daytona Beach area? Have the protests been fairly substantial?
Man, they've been beautiful. I'll tell you this. My organization, we hosted two. We hosted one about 2 weeks ago on a Friday, and then that following Sunday, we collaborated with a couple of organizations in town, and they've been beautiful. They have been beautiful. There have been people of all races, all ages, all sizes, all nationalities coming together and just declaring that finally, right now, everyone gets it. You know, mm-hmm. Everyone is coming together. There have been about 11 protests in Daytona Beach. There have been about three in New Smyrna Beach. There's been a couple in DeLand. There's been a few in the smaller cities like Deltona. So it's the Volusia County area has been protesting, and we are out here, and we are advocating and just letting people know that, you know, it's time for justice, and it's time for a change, and just to have that conversation finally. So it really feels good.
How many protests have you been involved in or helped coordinate in the past? And I'm wondering, just kind of thinking back to other movements, what feels different about now?
Gotcha. Altogether, I'll just say my organization, Community Healing Project, we've been initiated since about 2016. So we've mm-hmm. been featured in numerous protests, from Sandra Bland to the Eric Garner situation, Mike Brown situations. I actually went down to Sanford, Florida when Trayvon Martin was killed. About 8-9 years ago. So I've been out here. I'm very active. I'm very very mobile. When I say we're always at any protest, we try to get to at least every demonstration we can in our county. The past 2 weeks, I'll definitely say it's been exciting just to see that people that normally, you know, aren't as political or people that normally don't voice their opinions, they're out there with us. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a woman in a wheelchair literally protesting with us. And we walked the bridge. We walked our International Speedway bridge and back. We walked to City Hall and marched and protested. You know, and there were people out there for 12 hours with us. You know, mm-hmm. So I just think right now it's a change. You got to remember, people have been in their homes for 3 and 4 months, you know, with no money, nothing to do, barely any food. You know, children haven't been in school. So everyone's tense right now. So mm-hmm. when something like this happens, which was so ugly and disgusting, and it, you know, it finally brings everyone together, and people are finally saying, you know what, I have a right to protest, I have a right to petition, let's do it, let's finally make some noise. So, like I said, I'm very excited right now to be a millennial, and to be a Black man, I'm excited to see people finally understand what we've been trying to say the last 400 years.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rel Black. He is the founder of the Community Healing Project in Daytona Beach. We're talking about the notion of defunding the police or police reform at the very least, the protests that have swept the nation in the last couple of weeks. I want to hear from you as well. If you've been out protesting, or maybe you haven't and you have other reasons for that, let us know what you're thinking. Do you think there does need to be some systemic change to the police and the way policing is carried out? We are at WMFE on Twitter. You can reach us with your questions and comments there. Rel, you mentioned the protests in Sanford, Florida in 2012, and I mean, those were pretty big affairs. They garnered a lot of attention, not just nationally, but internationally too, and, you know, thousands of people pouring through the streets of a pretty sleepy town. Did that feel like a moment of change?
I'll say this. I'm only 27, so I was about 18. I would say about 18 or 19. I remember I just graduated from high school when that situation happened. So maybe from lack of experience or lack of just life lessons, when we all heard that not guilty verdict, and, you know, we saw protests, you know, a lot of us were kind of confused. I was confused. I didn't understand, you know, how could this happen? How could this man walk? How are there laws in place that would allow someone to commit a heinous crime, not against a black child, but against a child, regardless if they're black or white? They did it against a child, and now they're able to walk around and sell that gun and do all that stuff. So that really inspired me at a young age. So I started a blog. It was called Rails Reviews. And I just used to talk about different stuff in the news. I used to talk about different political issues. And, of course, a lot of my friends didn't really, you know, they didn't really support because we were young then. But that was the basis of how my activism started. And I think the difference between the Trayvon Martin situation and the George Floyd situation is because Trayvon Martin was really the catalyst, I would almost say, to this new black movement of speaking out and demanding change. You know, before that, we had incidents. We had a lot of incidents, like the Model Diablo situation in New York, and there was the young man, Corey Bell, that was shot and killed by the police officers. There was the Gina Six. There have been a lot of incidents, but I think with Trayvon Martin, it really hit home because we had a black president at the time, you know. For a lot of us, and I'm just speaking of my community, for a lot of us, we felt secure. We felt a level of comfortability with Obama, President Obama, that we had never felt before. You know, so for not only Trayvon Martin, but then for Sandra Bland to be murdered, then for Mike Brown to be murdered, for Eric Garner to be murdered, you know, all these things kept happening. And then Tamir Rice and Philando Castile, all these things kept happening under a black president. And so I think the last 8 or so years, this generation, now we're in our 20s now, we're almost 30. We're the ones out here speaking up because we're just sick of it. And it's getting to the point where there's nothing happening substantially. There's no consequences really being made. So we're really speaking out. And a lot of people are choosing to use their voice. A lot of people are, you know, going out and causing a ruckus. And hey, I definitely understand. But I know why it's gotten to this point. And it's really sad. It's sad that we've gotten to this point where we have to literally, you know, loot and riot just to get our point across when we've tried for 400 years, you know, 400 years in this country being peaceful. And we've had amazing icons that have led the way and shown us different paths of how to, you know, how to seek justice and how to get equal rights and how to get civil rights. You know, but I think now it's a beautiful time. The millennials are here, and we're being loud, and we're asking, if you want to move forward in this country, if you want a peaceful country, if you want a peaceful life, just give us some respect. That's all we ask. Give us some respect. Give us some justice. Let us know that our lives actually matter. And I think right now it's a beautiful time.
Let me ask, if I could, about the unrest, though. I mean, you mentioned looting and rioting and how some folks are kind of doing that to be heard. But, you know, the other story you're hearing is that there are people who are just kind of taking advantage of the protests to do things that they don't, you know, they don't actually have a connection to the folks who are protesting or necessarily they're not using it as a form of expression. It's just taking advantage of the situation. What's your view on that?
I'll say this. I'm torn because I spoke about this recently. I did my podcast last night on Deep Focus News, and I spoke about how, as like I said, as a 27-year-old, as a black man, as a millennial, I get it. You know, I don't need statistics. I don't need data. I am the statistic. You know, I know what it is. My life is literally what it is. So when you think, and we've had these amazing leaders, and we've had these amazing movements, and we fought for peace. Just recently, Colin Kaepernick lost his bread and butter. He lost his ability to feed his family because he peacefully protested for injustice. Now, 4 years later, that same organization that kicked them out and blacklisted them, now they're speaking out and saying, okay, we were wrong. we were wrong. Black lives do matter. We do understand. So I think with everyone looting and rioting, I'll say this. Martin Luther King himself said that rioting is the language of the unheard. Rioting is the language of the hurt. And that's mm-hmm. Martin Luther King, the king of peace. So if someone as profound and iconic and influential as him can say that, you know, there comes a point in time where enough is enough, you have to kind of understand why. And I get it. Trust me. I'm a business owner. I understand. I know how it is. I know how it is to work hard and to have someone come in and destroy everything that you've worked for. Mm-hmm. And I'll say this, property and buildings and businesses, they can be rebuilt. They can be rebuilt. It may take time. It may take a phenomenal amount of money, but they can be rebuilt. You know, people's lives can't be restored. And I think right now is the time that people are starting to understand that people have died. People have been killed. I don't even want to say died because that implies that it was natural. People have been killed by people that have been sworn to protect them. And the majority of the people are from one community, one race. So you have to ask, when people of all races are coming together, all cultures are coming together, all communities are coming together, and they are rioting, they are burning down buildings, they are making noise, they are smashing things and taking TVs and taking DVDs, because at this point, you got to remember, people have been locked up for 3 months. People mm-hmm. have been out of work. People haven't had any money. People haven't been able to pay their rent. People haven't been able to pay their car payments, so their cars are being repossessed. The children right. are uneasy. You know, it's a lot been going on. The American public has been, I don't want to say dismantled, but it's been really cracked the last 3 or so months with the epidemic. So
right.
I think a lot of people are using this as an advantage to go out and just steal things. But and I don't want to combine them with the people that are just truthfully out there that just have had enough and that are just truly just out there protesting, using their American rights. So I will say a lot of people are messing up the message by, you know, using this to take TVs and all that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. I'll never agree with that. But I will say I understand why people are rioting. I definitely understand.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. My guest is Rael Black. He's the founder of the Community Healing Project in Daytona Beach. I want to introduce as well our other guest, Sheriff Mike Chitwood from Volusia County. Sheriff Chitwood, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Thank you for joining us. I want to just kind of get your reaction for a start to the demonstrations. Have they sort of prompted a bit of soul searching for you?
Well, thank God, our protests, we've probably had a dozen so far, we have another one tonight, have been peaceful. Mm-hmm. They have been a cross-section of society, white, black, brown, yellow, purple, people from the same people from different socioeconomic backgrounds, and it's been interesting and refreshing to see that, because it's the First Amendment in action.
Mm-hmm. We've seen a lot of footage here in Orlando and across the country of, in some instances, police officers kneeling with protesters, praying with them, you know, kind of taking a knee. Have you seen that in Volusia County as well?
Well, I haven't seen that in our demonstrations, but, you know, everybody is entitled to their right to protest or whatever they feel. I don't condemn or condone either way. Everybody has to do what they believe is right in their heart.
Mm-hmm. And what about your deputies? How have they kind of been coping with and handling the last couple of weeks? What are they telling you?
I think that our law enforcement in Volusia County, while I'm not going to tell you we're perfect, I think that we're ahead of the curve and from a lot of other police departments in Volusia County, and I don't think that there's a cop in Volusia County that thinks what occurred in Minneapolis was not an atrocity and an affront to everything that a person pins a badge on their chest. For me, personally, have done this 33 years, while there are police issues there, sure, this is more of a humanity issue. What human being that has empathy in their heart and their soul would kneel there and continue to apply pressure on another human being who is begging to can't breathe and then is calling out for their mother? To me, it defies being part of the human race.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about reforming police policy in response to the nationwide demonstrations and what the notion of defunding the police actually means. We're with Volusia County Sheriff Mike Chitwood and Rael Black, founder of the Community Healing Project in Daytona Beach. Sheriff Chitwood and Rael, please stay with us. We'll be right back after this. listening to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about reforming police policy in response to nationwide demonstrations and the notion of defunding the police, what that actually means. Joining us are Volusia County Sheriff Mike Chitwood and Rel Black, who is the founder of the Community Healing Project in Daytona Beach. You can join the conversation too. Send us a tweet. What are your questions or concerns about the notion of defunding police or ideas for police reform? You can reach us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Sheriff Chitwood, when you hear that phrase defund police, what does that mean to you?
I think it's ludicrous. I think that the people that are screaming to defund the police are playing to a political ideology and throwing out red meat to them. Because I'll give you an example, the two quick examples. Mammoth University did a poll last week. 7 out of 10 Americans across racial lines said that they are overall satisfied with the service and direction of their local police departments. This week alone, I've been contacted by 7 different residents in 7 different areas of the county who's asked me to increase patrols for traffic issues in their neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about defunding the police, keep something in mind here. When you defund us, the first place that we have to cut, where we only have fat in our budget, is training and technology. And to get, I heard Mr. Black's point, he would be surprised to know we probably have more in common than this than we don't have in common on this issue. A lot of the things that we handle, mental illness, homelessness, school safety issues, we handle those issues because the federal government and the state government and county government and city government said, we're not dealing with this. Mm-hmm. We're going to turn it over to the cops. And that's why we're in the position that we're in now.
Well, Raul, let me throw that question to you. What does that expression defunding the police mean for you? And perhaps there's some nuance that we're not hearing.
Definitely. First of all, good afternoon, Sheriff Chitwood.
Good afternoon, sir. How's your foot?
I like to say, I'm pretty good. I'm pretty good. You know, I'm a little bit of pain, but I'm still fighting. Mm-hmm. I just want to say first, just the overall defund the police. I just want to just break that down. I think that whichever group decided to promote that idea, I wish they would have. Or whatever PR team decided to promote that idea and that phrase, I wish they would have done a little more, just made it a little more digestible for people. As a lot of people have stated, a lot of panelists and a lot of pundits have talked about, defunding the police doesn't mean abolishing the police or dismantling the police, because mm-hmm. that'd be absolutely ludicrous, like you said, Sheriff. That'd be chaotic.
Although to be fair, that is also something you will see on placards and billboards at some of these protests. But continue.
Yeah, no, I definitely understand what it means, but I think a lot of people are getting misconstrued when we say defund the police, and this is something that I definitely feel strongly about. It's not saying dismantling the police. It's not saying close police stations. It's not saying take police stations out of cities. What it's saying is for cities like New York City that have a $6.5 billion annual budget, you know, it's saying maybe we should reallocate some of those funds to some of the programs that are going on in the community and to some of those disenfranchised communities that may need those funds. We've seen throughout history, we've seen the most the communities that the police occupy the most are low income communities where people are at risk, disadvantaged, people who usually don't have jobs, people who usually don't have transportation, people who don't have access to health care. And those are the communities that the police occupy the most. So in my opinion, and the opinion of a lot of people my age, a lot of people that are out here, we're saying that, hey, we're not asking you to destabilize police officers. We're not asking you to shut it down, because that would be chaotic. And we need, like I just said, I just got hit by a car. Guess who the first person we called? The police. You know, so I would never say shut down police stations. But however, I am asking that as a nonprofit organization, as an organization that does need support and is out here in the community and does touch hands and has reached lives and has really changed lives, you know, we could definitely use some of the support that some of these police stations may be getting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not one to pull audits, and I'm not one to ask for that. But a lot of people have said, they've given me quotes about, say, $60 million of my city's budget goes to the police station. I say if we had 3% of that, maybe 5% of that, and reallocated it towards, you know, better healthcare facilities in the city, you know, public education system, you know, put back some of those cultural and performing arts programs back in the schools. And I like how the sheriff said, you know, the city, they may not want to deal with some of those things, so they give it to the police department. But I think the problem is, if the city dealt with it and let the community deal with it, and let community organizers and organizations, and let some of these, you know, some of these facilities deal with it, we could minimize crime. We wouldn't have to have the outpouring of police officers on our streets. We could reallocate those police officers and reallocate that, and instead of, you know, placing more officers into health communities, you repurpose that money and put it into public housing and job opportunities and funds for small businesses in those communities, so you don't have the crime. You know, of course, it won't eradicate crime. Nothing's going to eradicate crime. I understand that. But if you come out and say put $2 million into a community reserve pot that says, you know, we're going to have money for agriculture, we're going to have money for small businesses, we're going to have access to health care regardless how much money you make. You know, these are the kind of issues that my community deal with. And I was born and raised, Sheriff Chitwood, he knows, Daytona Beach. I was born and raised in Caroline Village. It's not the most beautiful neighborhood. It's not the most progressive neighborhood. But I am a product of my neighborhood. I'm proud of where I'm from. But I know that my neighborhood needs help. We need better social services for mental health. Mm-hmm. We need to, you know, food and grocery options. So if there is a way, if there is any way possible, like I said, I would never, absolutely never say destroy the police station. I would never say shut down police officers because we need them. Like I just said, it's going to get hit by a car, and the first person we call was a police officer.
Right.
So I definitely would love. I would love if some of those funds got reallocated. Not to go on too much, but that's really my.
Quite a lot to unpack there. I do want to get to a couple of questions we're getting on Twitter. Newsy Woozy wrote, he has actually a few questions here, but a couple of things he's asking about are what it would cost to train police in alternatives to gun usage. And he's also asking about the Camden solution, which he says nearly doubled the police presence in that county, that's in New Jersey, and asking if that plan could work here. And just from my reading of what happened in Camden, New Jersey, is they essentially dismantled and then reformed the police station.
Crime decreased 25%.
Indeed, I want to ask about the first thing, though, about training. And Sheriff Chitwood, I mean, to your point earlier about the Sheriff's Office, I know you've been sort of working on some of the de-escalation training and the like. How important is training and how expensive is it to train police to use other means than potentially deadly force?
Yeah, let me first tell you that, to Mr. Black's point, the greatest cop that I ever met in the world was called economic development, and I'll leave it at that one. The training that we do, I mean, I'll give you an example. You can't train in a vacuum. All of Volusia County or all of Orange County or all of Seminole County, if you train together constantly, mm-hmm. you get groupthink. So the objective is when we do training, we want people to go to different parts of the country, and in some cases where I went to Scotland, to look at other democracies. In Scotland's case, they don't carry firearms.
Right.
They still deal with mentally ill people with firebombs and knives and machetes. How do they handle it? How do they recruit? How do they train? Some of those techniques we brought back to Daytona Beach, and obviously we brought to the sheriff's office. One is the duty to intervene. You know, do you want a warrior police force or a guardian police force? The duty to intervene is what guardians do. Our de-escalation training, we had an outside agency come in, the Police Executive Research Forum, which is a Washington-based think tank. They spent a year here. They went through our policies, our procedures, our training, our culture, and then issued a 90-page report, which you could read online. Every deputy, including myself, has gone through that. We reduced use of force by 60% in 2019, the first year we were done.
Mm-hmm.
We've also given out 24 de-escalation medals where there were situations where deadly force could have been used, but it wasn't. And as a result of that, the person was taken into custody without a shot being fired. So these are the things that you have to look. And the other thing is the standards of training are different everywhere you go. You know, there's 18,000 police departments in this country. Everybody doesn't train the same. Mm-hmm. And the smaller police departments probably don't really train at all. Or train to the level that the bigger ones do. So there's a lot of food for thought here when you discuss these things. I think if you can shout out the far right and the far left and take a deep breath and bring folks to the table to have a discursive debate, George Floyd's death will be exactly what his six-year-old daughter said. My daddy changed the world.
Thank
and you have the momentum now for that to happen. There's people across the line that want to see change. If you get the cooler heads to prevail, get politics out of it, you can see real headway on the social justice side as well as on the law enforcement side.
Yeah, getting politics out of it may be a little tricky. I want to read another tweet here from Andre, who writes, besides voting in elections, what other actions are available to create effective change in diminishing police budgets and also holding police accountable? And Sheriff, I get the sense that probably you and Rel may not see eye to eye on the budget part of the piece, but as far as holding police accountable, Rel, your thoughts on that for a start? I mean, what are the kind of things that you would like to see change there?
Yeah, definitely. First thing I want to say, last night, Mr. Sheriff, I was with Mr. Dwayne Fernandez on our podcast last night, and one of the main things that we spoke about was accountability. And I was saying with the case of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd right now, the issue isn't that, you know, officers are killing. We know officers are killing black people. We know officers are, you know, they're killing unarmed citizens. However, it's the accountability that's the issue. It's the fact that once it happens, the only thing that usually happens is they go on administrative leave, which means they're paid, you know, at home, and it becomes a public thing. People protest. The court usually lets them off on a manslaughter charge or something of a smaller degree, and then the world forgets about it, and they usually get rehired. What a lot of people and a lot of social justice organizations and a lot of advocates are saying right now is it's the time. You know, we're asking to reallocate the funds. Okay, we're already asking that. Now it's time on the opposite end. We're asking, what can we do to prevent this? What's going to happen every time this happens? So I've proposed a couple of, you know, just in my ideas, some ideas first. Arrested, like if an officer kills someone that's unarmed, or an officer kills someone that is clearly, and I know this doesn't happen all the time, but there's video footage out now, everyone goes live. If you see an officer that commits a crime, no matter what, if it's murder, they have to be charged, they have to be held accountable, and they have to be put on a public trial for the entire world to see, or the entire country or whatever the nation to see, because it trickles down from there. If you set an example, like right now in Minneapolis, they're setting an example with those officers. So from our eyes as an activist, it looks like people are finally saying, hey, listen, we're going to set the tone. We won't allow this anymore in our nation. And you have to hold these officers accountable. And I'm a very intelligent young man. I understand that, you know, certain groups, certain industries, everyone's sworn to silence. Everyone protects each other. Everyone protects your brother. I grew up in a community. You have to, you know, you got to protect where you're from. I get it. But when you hold officers accountable, and when you see someone doing something wrong and you don't speak about it, you have to be held accountable as well. That's why all four of those officers in Minneapolis, I feel like they're being charged, because even though only one of them committed the crime, the other three allowed it to happen. Mm-hmm. So it starts there. It's accountability. Yep. You gotta hold people accountable, and that goes for the opposite end too. People commit a crime, they have to be held accountable.
We are kind of running short on time. I hear what you're saying, Raul. I just want to give the sheriff that's fine. A minute to respond, though. I mean, what about that accountability piece, Sheriff? And what are your thoughts on making sure that officers are held accountable?
All police administrators want accountability. We all want it for our troops. But you have to look. There's a layer of what goes on here. There's years and years and years. There's a Florida statute that lets the union get involved in the disciplinary process and the policy process. Florida statute. The Florida legislature has put that in there. That blocks accountability.
Does that need to change then?
That legislature's got to change that. It's statute, Florida statute 117. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is due process. Even a police officer who broke the law is entitled to due process. And when people were screaming that the cop wasn't locked up quickly enough, sure, he could have locked them up out there and charged him with first-degree murder, and he would have got off. Because what the prosecutor did out there, and I admired what he did, let's get all the facts. Let's get the autopsy back. We see what we see on video. Let's see where we're going. And then he charged third degree. And then when more information came in, he bumped it up to second degree. Mm-hmm. That's responsibility. He wants to make sure that prosecutor, when he goes in front of a jury, that the facts and circumstances are going to get a conviction. That's what he wants to do. And to get to the other point about the other guys being held accountable,
we are actually going to have to leave it there, but there's more to say on this conversation. We'll revisit it another time. Volusia County Sheriff Mike Chitwood, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
And Rel Black, founder of the Community Healing Project in Daytona Beach. Rel, thank you as well.
Thank you guys so much.
Stay tuned. UCF journalism instructor Rick Brunson joins us after this. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. These are challenging times to be working in the media. Protests across the country have put a spotlight on some of the risks faced by journalists, while the coronavirus pandemic is putting financial pressure on some media organizations, triggering layoffs and furloughs. Well, joining us to discuss the state of the media is Rick Brunson, associate instructor at the Nicholson School of Media and Communications at the University of Central Florida. Rick, thanks for being here.
Matthew, it's always great to be with you.
And we'll talk more about those challenges in a moment. But first, I want to ask you about a new project that UCF's Nicholson School of Communications has launched. It's called winterparksunshine.org. Rick, what's going on with that project?
Yeah, so we launched in March, we meaning the Nicholson School, launched a new website that's called winterparksunshine.org. Winterparksunshine.org. And what it is, it's a grant-funded research project that has resulted in this website that contains multiple searchable databases that spotlight the activities going on in the city of Winter Park, especially its municipal government. So we launched this during Florida Sunshine Week, which seemed appropriate on March the 20th, and we're up and running, and people who live in Winter Park, citizens, residents, can go to it, and we have a several searchable databases that they can look at to see and find data and public records that are related to how their city commission is functioning in terms of how they're voting on issues and measures in the city, how they're spending taxpayer money. They can look at campaign contributions given to the commissioners and the mayor, what the voter role makeup looks like in Winter Park. And we're working on several other database and data sets that we're adding all the time, including next we're going to do a salaries database and a public works database that tracks every public works project in the city, how much it costs, and status to completion. So it's a pretty interesting, very civically minded project that really promotes civic engagement in a hyper local space like Winter Park.
Why did you pick Winter Park from the get go? Like, what was the motivation there?
Yeah, so that's the most popular question that we get asked, and the answer is pure and simple: is this is a grant funded project. So the donor who came to us, donors I should say, Glenn and Rosemary Salo, are Winter Park residents, and they live in the city, and they came to us because they were concerned at the diminishing quantity of coverage related to Winter Park. The Winter Park Observer, the hyperlocal newspaper there, had shuttered a year ago in May, and a lot of the other news organizations don't have a regular presence there in terms of a bureau. There is the Winter Park Voice. There's the 32789 digital site that has started recently. But a lot of the coverage there tends to be sporadic instead of day-to-day and beat-like. And so the Salos came to us because they wanted to partner with us in hopes of remedying that situation.
So the project that you're involved in really speaks to a bit of a gap in local media. And I mean, the fact that the Winter Park Observer had closed a year ago, you know, that's a local newspaper that had really spent the reporting that it was doing on focusing on those hyperlocal issues. Even, you know, papers like the Orlando Sentinel, they've kind of thinned out their ranks as far as people who cover those commission meetings in some of the cities around Central Florida. So can an organization like UCF pick up the slack? I mean, is it possible to expect that journalism training institutes can sort of fill some of that gap? Or is this just a way for you to figure out what the future might look like as papers kind of thin out?
I think it's both. It's both the things that you've mentioned. You know, the Winter Park Observer was led by a bright young journalist who was a former student of mine, Tim Freed, who did a fantastic job in his coverage of the city, was well-respected and did a great job. The Sentinel, you know, continues to do a fantastic job in covering Central Florida, but many of its reporters now have multiple beats. So, you know, the reporter who covers Winter Park not only is responsible for covering Winter Park, but other municipalities and other topics and issues. And so it's a question of, you know, the reporting staffs in Central Florida being spread very, very thin, and they're doing a great job, but they are spread really thin. And so we're just, you know, as a research university, that we're this, you know, part of our research mission at UCF is to try to help provide solutions to burgeoning problems, all kinds of problems in this, in the communities that, that we service. And whether it's, you know, coming up with solutions for the pandemic as you know, researchers in our biomedical sciences departments are doing, or in this case, whether it's trying to come up with a solution to news deserts and diminishing, you know, coverage in local communities. We're just trying to be part of the solution. And we're grateful that we have a donor who wants to partner with us to do that.
What about the uptake of the website or the impact you're having so far? Like, how many people are using it and what are they using it for?
Yeah, so I mentioned that we launched on March the 20th, which was right about the time things started shutting down because the coronavirus. So, you know, people had a lot of things on their mind other than hyperlocal, you know, public records. And so we had a really nice spike at the beginning of interest, and then things sort of waned off. But then it picked up again in May. And as things have begun to reopen, we've seen a big jump in interest in the site, especially in the number of subscribers. We have somewhere around 105 or so people who have subscribed to the website for updates that we send out and new data sets that we send out. And then we've also, time on site has been good. It averages about 4 to 4.5 minutes. We're so far trafficking in the hundreds, not the thousands yet, but several hundred people are looking at us on a regular basis. And there are 30,000 people in the city. So we hope to, as we go on and word gets out about the site and more people discover it, find out about it, traffic will continue and we'll reach more of those 30,000 people.
And do you have a sense of who is looking at it? Like, is it just residents of Winter Park? Is it kind of data journalism junkies? Like, who's accessing the information?
Yeah, right now it's people who live in Winter Park. If you've ever gone to a Winter Park City Commission meeting, people in Winter Park are extremely passionate about their local politics. It's a wonder. It's an amazing thing to behold at how engaged people are in that city with the issues that are going on in their city. So people who live there are the ones primarily who've been looking at the site already and who we're hearing from in terms of email. And they're suggesting data sets to us. For instance, several have reached out to us saying they would like to see more data about the ongoing overlay project, about the library project. They want to see timelines. They want to see spending reports and things like that. So they're reaching out to us and suggesting things that they want to see. That's the cool thing, Matthew, about the site and the project is it's kind of a very non-traditional journalistic approach. We're not doing stories. We're not doing traditional news coverage in terms of narrative stories and going out and doing a 90-second, you know, video package with narration. It's a database site. I mean, it puts the citizen in the driver's seat. We don't editorialize. We don't take positions. You come to the site. You pick a topic or a data set that you're interested in, and it's all searchable and sortable, and you get the information that you're looking for.
Are you hoping that this site is going to be self-sustaining at some point? I mean, you mentioned subscribers, but are they subscribers who pay something to have access to that, or is it just you sign up for it?
You just sign up for it. It's totally free. Right now, it is completely funded by the donor. It's a two-year project. Our hope is that if it is successful, and by successful, we mean a high level of penetration in the city of Winter Park, and that people actually seem to be using it regularly to engage with the city, with the democracy in the city, with the government in their city. They use it to formulate decisions that they make about voting. If it's successful in that way, we're hoping that it will continue to be funded. And the big dream here, if we can be ambitious, is that we would like to replicate this in other small cities in UCF's coverage area that may have and may be getting scant news coverage. So we hope that we can replicate it down the line.
If you're just joining me, my guest is Rick Brunson. He's an associate instructor at the Nicholson School of Media and Communications at the University of Central Florida. Rick, I want to pivot for a minute and talk more about the challenges that are facing the news industry more kind of globally, especially in the last couple of months. The pandemic, for a start, that has really put some strains on newsrooms, news organizations like newspapers. I mean, a lot of big papers have had to furlough employees and lay folks off with the kind of restrictions on advertising that they've faced in the last couple months. And that's just the start of it. Right now, we're covering pretty widespread protests, and there are some specific challenges to that a lot of journalists are suddenly thrust into. When you sort of step back and take a look at what's going on now, what's your sense of what it's like to be a journalist at this point in time and in the history of the United States?
Yeah, so as a journalism educator, I have students literally working all over the country right now and in this moment, and I'm in regular contact with a lot of them. And, you know, the media business, and I've been on your program before, and we've discussed this, before the pandemic, the economics of the news industry were, especially for newspapers, a bit grim, you know. Yeah. And the news industry was struggling before we got to this point in 2020. But, you know, 36,000 workers at news companies in the United States have been laid off, furloughed, or had their pay cut in the last 3 months. And what this means, and kind of what is so troubling about this, is it's happening exactly at the moment when interest in news is at an all-time high. I mean, people are voraciously reading online newspapers. Millions of people are turning into newscasts to seek out information, reliable information, about what is going on with this pandemic. And now, you know, the crisis that we're covering in the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd and all of those conversations that are starting. So right at the moment when you need journalists the most, we have 36,000 of them who have been idled or sidelined in some way. And so what does this practically look like in our own backyard, in our own neighborhood? So the Orlando Sentinel is owned by Tribune Publishing. Full disclosure, I worked there for 20 years, so I have a lot of friends there. I love the newspaper. I'm a subscriber. But Tribune Publishing, which owns the Sentinel, several of the newspapers, Chicago Tribune, others, cut the salaries of those making more than $67,000 a year by 2 or 10%. The company has issued 3-week furloughs for employees who make between $40,000 and $67,000. That's a lot of the folks in the newsroom. So yeah. I have former students such as Chris Reyes, who is a justice and safety reporter. Think about that for a second. He's the justice and safety reporter. What two issues right now are at the forefront of what's going on in our country? Justice and right. Safety, right? And so he's had to sit at home some in the last 3 weeks instead of being out there covering this time of crisis. Mm-hmm. Now, he is back out there. He was out there this weekend covering the protests in Orlando and doing a fantastic job. But we have journalists who are sidelined and sitting at home at just the moment we need them. I've got another student who works for Gannett. You know, we've been on your program before talking about Gannett and Gatehouse. Mm-hmm. They're now the largest publisher of newspapers in the country, and 250 daily newspapers. Gannett ordered the majority of its 24,000 employees to take 5 days off per month without pay in April, May, and June. Executives are taking a 25% pay cut. So I have a student, a former student, Crystal Hayes, who is USA Today's congressional reporter. Mm-hmm. Okay. She's the congressional reporter. So there have been days where she's had to sit in her apartment instead of being on the floor covering Congress. Think about that. I mean, she filed an amazing story last week where the Senate was debating an anti-lynching bill. Think about this. We're debating an anti-lynching bill in 2020. It was a historic debate. Thankfully, she was there to cover it. But, you know, what happens if something like that comes along and she's not there to cover it? I mean, we as citizens are diminished when that happens.
Now, we've talked about sort of trust in the media before, too, on this program, Rick. And I'm wondering, given the fact that there is this massive appetite for information about what's going on, whether it's about the pandemic, whether it's about the protests that have been sweeping the country in the last couple of weeks, do you get the sense that the tide is turning there? Because that is something that has maybe eroded a little bit in the last few years, right? The notion that, the Fourth Estate is a trustworthy source of information. People are questioning that, and I'm wondering if that may be changing now that people do need this information now more than ever.
I think more people are tuning in and reading than ever before, but I think their skepticism still remains there, and skepticism is fine. You know, mm-hmm. what isn't helpful is, you know, cynicism, where you just discount everything and cynics don't watch, right? But people are tuning in more than ever. But Americans, I think, still tend to be skeptical of what they're reading and what they're watching. But they're watching, and they're tuning in, and they're relying on what organizations like yours at WMFE and your team of reporters are doing. And you know, you have partners, and your partners trust you. And subscribers subscribe, you have a level of trust with your listeners. And I think we're seeing in moments of crisis like this more of a reliance on the news media. And I hope some of that trust is edging up. Pew Research, which is nonpartisan and tracks this kind of thing, published a story in late May that said that 60% of American news consumers that they surveyed said that they somewhat trust what they're seeing and reading, and that by and large the news media is doing generally a pretty good job at covering the pandemic. So I'll take 60%. I would like it to be higher, but I'll take the majority of the country.
Just in the last minute or so we have here, Rick, thinking about the next generation of journalists that you're educating right now, what's the kind of landscape going to look like for them in the next sort of 5-10 years, do you think?
Well, look, we just had an amazing spring semester at UCF where, you know, within 4 days, all of us who were teaching face-to-face classes had to flip a switch and teach everything online, which meant, you know, teaching people how to report stories when they can't interview people in person, much like your own reporters and journalists and much like we're doing today, right? Instead of sitting in your studio, I'm sitting at my home and you're sitting at your home, right? Mm-hmm. So we've had to teach innovatively our students, how do you report in a pandemic safely? And on top of that, how do you get a job in a moment when 40 million Americans have lost theirs, right? And the good thing that I've seen just anecdotally is that my best students who graduated this spring got jobs in the news media as producers. We've landed students at TV stations in this market and beyond this market. So our most promising students with the highest potential are still getting employed. But, you know, I wonder and worry about the backwash of this and how damaged the economy is going to be into the future and the impact this is going to have down the line on revenue streams for, you know, commercial news media. You know, this is going to scar us a bit, I think, and that's going to impact the job market.
Rick Brunson is Associate Instructor at the Nicholson School of Media and Communications at the University of Central Florida. Rick, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Matthew, for having me on. It's always great to be with you.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Production assistance for this week's show from Juan Gualda and Bill Johnson. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. When you donate right now to support WMFE, you're making all the news and information you rely on available for everyone free of charge. Visit WMFE.org to make a contribution. And thanks. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.